Hello, this is Jackie Cohen, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Monday, December 8th issue of the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Natural World Heritage Sites, Growing Threat. Climate change, human activities, and underfunding impact treasured ecosystems. Botswana's fertile Okavango Delta is one of the last remaining high biodiversity ecosystems in the world, home to cheetahs, African wild dogs, baobab trees, crocodiles, termites, and owls that catch fish. Roughly the size of the state of Connecticut, the freshwater Okavango Delta opens into an enormous alluvial fan that stretches up to 5,800 square miles into the Kalahari Desert. The area is so vast it can be seen from space, but most people have never heard of it. In recognition of its natural and cultural significance, the Okavango Delta was designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 2014. When I conducted research in the Okavango in 2024, I witnessed both its natural beauty and the ebullient warmth of the people who live there. The health of the Delta and of 270 other natural sites across the globe is the subject of the latest IUCN World Heritage Outlook, a recurring wellness report on the planet's most treasured natural places. The report's findings are not dire, but they aren't great either. Many of these extraordinary places are increasingly at risk due to escalating climate change, invasive species, and a lack of consistent funding to protect them. The Outlook. Every few years, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, a global contingent of more than 1,400 government agencies and private organizations focused on environmental conservation, evaluates the environmental and biological conditions at all UNESCO World Heritage sites selected for their natural significance. That includes the Okavango Delta in Botswana, home to the world's largest population of African elephants, the Central Amazon Conservation Complex in Brazil, the Socotra Archipelago in Yemen with hundreds of species of birds and fish, the Tropical Rainforest Heritage of Sumatra, Indonesia, and Everglades National Park in Florida. The IUCN reports to UNESCO on each site's current state and natural value, the threats it faces, the effectiveness of its protection and management, and actions needed to secure its future. The IUCN rates each site's status from good to critical as a way of tracking its conservation progress over time. The most recent report, the fourth in a series that began in 2014, was presented at the IUCN World Conservation Congress on October 11th. Overall, the report documents a decline in the conditions of these remarkable places. The proportion of World Heritage sites with a positive conservation outlook, good or good with some concerns, has dropped to 57% after remaining at 63% in 2014, 2017, and 2020. In addition, the proportion of sites considered of significant concern or critical has increased in the last 5 years from 37% to 43%. Many of those are in Mesoamerica, Africa, and South America, as well as the Middle East, North Africa, and the Mediterranean. Threats from the natural world. The report identifies several key challenges affecting heritage sites. The most widespread conservation challenge the report identifies is climate change. Climate-related changes in biological conditions, such as ocean acidity, salt concentrations, sediment buildup, droughts, flooding and groundwater flow, and variable temperatures are considered high or very high threats to 117 of the 271 heritage sites evaluated, 43% of them. One-third of the 50 World Heritage sites that contain glaciers will see those glaciers disappear by 2050, the report projects. Around the world, coral reefs have been and are still bleaching, turning white as the colorful organisms that build and inhabit them die off, affecting 30% of the 29 World Heritage-listed coral reef ecosystems. In addition, invasive species are encroaching on World Heritage sites. For example, In Ecuador's Galapagos Islands, invasive species like rats and feral cats are considered one of the main causes of extinctions, including to the island's famous birds. In Australia's Gondwana rainforest, the last vestiges of an ancient plant and animal living museum are retreating due to invading non-native species. Threats from people. Additional human pressures are also endangering these unique areas. Threats to these sites from the outside include logging and mining in the region, developing nearby land, diverting natural water flows, and polluting the air, water, and land. Roughly two-thirds of the sites studied face at least some danger from human activities happening outside the site's formal boundaries. In addition, the report says heritage sites need more financial support to be better able to respond to key threats. It finds that most lack consistent long-term funding for staff salaries, ecosystem monitoring, and continued maintenance of protection programs. Chronic underfunding is the primary barrier to effective ecosystem management. Funding typically comes from organizations such as the World Heritage Fund or the Global Environmental Facility, an organization made up of 186 member countries, institutions, non-governmental organizations, and the private sector that funds environmental projects worldwide. The IUCN report warns that even effective initiatives may struggle in the long term without stronger regional, national, and global support. That could include efforts like the Okavango's Community Management for Protected Area Conservation Program, which connects rural communities and conservationists to support both people and nature. What is missing from the 2025 report? There is good news, though. Targeted local action, such as anti-poaching efforts and local community involvement, have improved conditions at four sites in West and Central Africa, shifting their status from critical to significant concern. There is more to know about these sites and how they are faring. As a community-based conservation scholar, I recognize that while the major drivers of ecological decline can be gleaned from published research, specific causes of that decline are best learned on the ground. The outlook provides critical environmental trends, but it could be strengthened by including specifics based on quantitative community-based monitoring, such as wildlife population surveys by local experts. For instance, at a conference I attended in 2024, a frog biologist from Botswana observed that, before her work, the previous frog study in that part of the delta was in 1980. While critical local and indigenous knowledge is recognized in the report, it is largely excluded from assessments, both because weaving it with conventional scientific analysis is difficult, or because communities may choose to protect certain knowledge. The Okavango Delta is one of many World Heritage sites, living landscapes rich with local cultural value and global significance. Like many remote heritage sites outside Europe and North America, there is a lot that remains unknown about biodiversity in the Okavango. The report acknowledges that recognizing the relationship between people and the environment would also improve future assessments. Overall, it offers a clear picture of global conservation trends while also acknowledging local realities and successes. For the heritage sites across the planet, conservation succeeds when people and nature thrive together. New York Lead Registry applies to rentals. Rules require landlords to inspect and repair. A new lead rental registry has gone into effect throughout New York, prompting inspections of rental units built before 1980. The registry is part of the state's efforts to prevent lead poisoning in children, with the most likely source being peeling or chipping lead-based paint and dust. The 25 communities of concern in the registry include Rochester, Utica, Rome, Binghamton, Elmira, Poughkeepsie, Middletown, New Rochelle, and Yonkers. The Lead Rental Registry is the department's largest undertaking in addressing childhood lead poisoning since the launch of our Childhood Lead Poisoning Primary Prevention Program, said State Health Commissioner Dr. James McDonald. it moves the needle from reactive lead poisoning intervention to proactively addressing lead hazards in rental homes before a child is lead poisoned. Local health departments are contacting rental property owners to apply for the Lead Safe New York Registry, created by a law that went into effect on November 3rd. The program requires buildings with two or more units built before 1980 to comply with the law, which requires landlords to inspect and repair any lead hazards. Property owners are asked to share information on the program with tenants. Instructions for scheduling a lead hazard inspection will come from the local health department. The process of remediation includes searching indoors, outdoors, and common areas with lead hazards, like paint on molding or windows. The inspection also includes dust wipe sampling and bare soils that may contain lead. Funding from the state is available to help make necessary repairs by hiring lead-safe certified contractors. Once the repair work is complete, a certificate is issued by the local health department that must be renewed at least every 3 years. Failure to comply with the registry requirements for registration, inspection, and tenant notification can result in penalties and fines under the state's public health law. About half of homes built before 1978 have lead-based paint, according to the EPA. About 69% of homes built between 1940 and 1959 have lead-based paint. 87% of homes built prior to 1940 have lead-based paint. The city of Rochester already has a lead law, adopted in 2005, which requires inspection of lead paint hazards as part of the city's inspection processes for rental units built before 1978. URMC program has doubled lung cancer screenings. Lung cancer is known to be the leading cause of cancer-related mortality in the United States. Getting an annual lung cancer screening can be one of the best options to consider. A new program launched by UR Medicine Primary Care in 2022 has helped more than double lung screening rates. A recent study shows how the network reached a nearly 72% lung cancer screening rate in June 2025, whereas in March 2022, the network had a 33% lung cancer screening rate. Robert Fortuna, professor of primary care and pediatrics at the University of Rochester Medical Center, was the lead author of the study. "Our biggest success was not only screening a high percentage of eligible patients, but also enrolling those patients in the comprehensive program to ensure they receive the necessary annual follow-up screenings," Fortuna said in a statement. "The program was designed to better identify and reach patients who meet the criteria for lung cancer screening." Through this program, providers are able to calculate PAC year smoking history more accurately and to notify patients who are eligible for lung cancer screenings. People who should consider getting lung cancer screenings, those between 50 and 80 years old, those who currently smoke cigarettes or quit within the last 15 years, people who have a smoking history of at least one pack of cigarettes per day for 20 years and have no signs or symptoms of lung cancer. How mayors are tackling housing crisis. The high-profile election of Zohran Mamdani as mayor of New York City has spotlighted the role local governments play in housing matters. Mamdani ran on a campaign of affordability, and while some of his specific proposals may be less relevant or not possible for cities elsewhere in the country, the message seems to resonate everywhere. Other mayors have long grappled with the housing crisis in their own backyards. A January 2025 report from the U.S. Conference of Mayors found that more than half of the 120 mayors surveyed expect housing shortfalls in the thousands of units in their cities in the coming years. To find out what's going on around America, USA Today spoke with five mayors, all of whom call housing a priority. Most offered a few words of advice for Mamdani, though one demurred. Each had plenty to say about their own challenges. Interviews have been edited for clarity. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Carmel, Indiana. Republican Mayor Sue Finkham was elected mayor of this small city just north of Indianapolis in 2023. Finkham is proud of the accolades Carmel has received from national media. Best small city in America from Wallet Hub, number 2 best place to live in the U.S. from Architectural Digest, among others. That helps attract new residents, but Carmel also works to retain and bring back those who grew up in town but may feel priced out. Apartments are controversial in town, Finkham told USA Today. Carmel had very few until recently, but she sees value in having diversity in housing options. Many longtime residents thought apartments were evil, but recent efforts to add housing near a rail trail have changed many people's views. We did a back-of-the-napkin study on who was living in the apartments and found that about one-third were 55-plus, Finkham said. Some were people who had moved here post-COVID and haven't been able to find a house. Others had lived here forever, and others were those who just thought they'd try this lifestyle. I heard over and over again, well, I got a 6-month lease, but I realized this is so cool to walk my dog and see my neighbors and get a coffee and be really active, be in the heart of the community where everything's happening. Now people are re-upping their leases and scrapping plans to buy a house. Most of the city's housing stock is 4-bedroom, 2.5-bath houses of 2 stories on a half-acre lot, Finkham said. Not ideal for a young person and not ideal for empty nesters. To encourage people to right-size and to offer ownership opportunities, the city has tried to prioritize condo development. Providence, Rhode Island. Democrat Brett Smiley became mayor of Providence, the capital of Rhode Island, in 2023. He has spent much of the time since then working on housing issues, calling it an urgent priority. Last year, we ranked on a couple of the lists as having some of the fastest growing rents in the country, Smiley said. He's glad people are choosing Providence, but dismayed that longtime residents are struggling to stay in place. We don't aspire to be a place that only certain people can afford to be. To bring community residents on board, city leaders spent a year and a half in nearly 100 public meetings scattered around the city. Everyone had a chance to see what was being proposed so that it wasn't rumor or fear, Smiley explained. You could actually look at the map, touch it, feel it, see your block. Nobody felt like it was being done to them. It felt like it was being done with them. And I'm really proud of my community for engaging in that process and for being willing to do something that most cities and towns don't do. Asked if he had any advice for Mayor-elect Mamdani, Smiley said, if a problem is complex, be wary of simple solutions. The approach we're taking in Providence is robust and comprehensive. We are not doing just one thing. We're making sure we don't lose any of our existing housing so that we're not taking one step forward with new construction, but then 2 steps backward by having old affordable properties come offline. And we're providing protections for tenants because we know that they need it. Clearfield, Utah. This small city, about 20 miles north of Salt Lake, is home to Hill Air Force Base. Mark Shepard, a Republican, was first elected mayor in 2013. Shepard laughs when he calls being mayor or a part-time gig. He also runs a real estate brokerage in town. We started noticing a few years ago a real problem with our airmen in that they were having to live double, triple, quadruple in an apartment to be able to afford housing. They're at my food banks because they can't afford rent. That to me is criminal, Shepard told USA Today. Shepard feels that developers, real estate agents, and legislators blame cities for the housing shortage because local zoning is terrible, he said. And while there's some truth to that, to me, one of the most dangerous things that we could ever say is, hey, cities, we're taking your zoning rights away from you. We're going to allow multifamily housing or dense housing anywhere. He's a staunch supporter of control staying with the people who live in the communities. We know what works in our cities. For state legislatures, Shepard said, taking away local control because a few cities aren't doing what they need to do is a blunt instrument. Legislatively, you can't say Shepherd City is the bad apple and we're going to punish Shepherd City. You have to do it to the entire state. Advice for Mamdani? Look to the future, not just the here and now. We have to look forward and say, okay, what does this do to us long term? We cause more problems if we don't. When we dropped rates the way we did to spark an economy, it was meant to be a short-term fix. And we left it that way for way, way, way too long, and now we're facing the consequences. Raleigh, North Carolina. Janet Cowell, a Democrat, was elected in 2024. Housing was at the top of her list of priorities. Like other mayors USA Today interviewed, that's because her city, also a state capital, has seen explosive growth in recent years. Lots of folks just want to see you build affordable units, and if you build anything else, you're ignoring the needs of the community, Cowell said. I was just reading an email from a constituent saying, if you approve this housing, you're going to show that you don't care. Why don't you build housing for people who need it, not market rate higher end housing? Some residents want inclusivity in the housing plan beyond what's realistic, Cowell finds. For example, building affordable housing in expensive areas downtown. We understand that, she said, but a subsidy for a single unit downtown can be $200,000, whereas a subsidy for a unit out on the outskirts of town may be $20,000. There's these real trade-offs of saying, yes, we need to put a stake in the ground and have some affordable units downtown, but what's the balance? I'd rather have 10 people housed than one person housed, even if it means they may have to take a bus. Cowell values constituent concerns, she said, but her priority is results. I'm trying to get housing on the ground. The metrics I'm interested in are both affordable subsidized units and all market units. You educate residents as best you can, but then you make the decisions and just keep moving. Her advice for Mamdani is that local context is everything, but local efforts take place within an interconnected web of various levels of government. There are different housing toolkits in different areas, she told USA Today. It is an intricate negotiation and relationship management exercise to move forward at a local level and try to have that independence and agency, but know that you do have to work and think about all of these other players. They will certainly have their opinions. I think they've shown themselves more recently to increasingly want to take away control from locals or do things that impact us. Columbus, Ohio. Many of the mayors interviewed hold one or more roles in national leadership groups. Democrat Andrew Ginther, mayor of Columbus since 2016, is the immediate past president of the influential U.S. Conference of Mayors, a role in which he tried to address the national housing crisis. Columbus is also a capital city, and like some of the other municipalities profiled here, has enjoyed years of strong population growth. Regional government leaders anticipate an additional population boom over the next several years. To address the city's housing needs, Ginther focuses on other interested parties. 10 years ago, a lot of private sector leaders thought of this being more of a moral issue, Ginther said. Wanting to fight homelessness is the right thing to do. Now they know our economic development trajectory and our ability to continue to grow our economy and for them to attract the best and the brightest from around the state and country and the world depends on housing. Our ability to continue to grow and create jobs is at risk unless we have places for families to live. Reports suggest the Columbus region needs 200,000 more housing units in the region over the next decade, and he's volunteered to create half of those units, 100,000, in the city. Part of being leader as a city is acting regionally, Ginther asserts. He understands that not every community can commit to every kind of housing, like supportive homes for people exiting homelessness, for example. But everybody can do 55 plus communities. Everybody can do some multifamily for seniors. I'll take on some of the more challenging and difficult populations, but I need everybody to do their part. I need the rest of the region to step up with updating their zoning codes, their land use policies, and really embrace housing. Ginther didn't want to give specific advice to New York City's incoming mayor, but said that the best way to have maximum impact and grow a sustainable movement is by bringing everyone together under some common themes and values and inviting everyone in to be a part of the solution. Folks may not choose to accept the invitation. They may not be willing to be part of the larger effort, but the more you try, you can get a heck of a lot more done. ICE detains father of local immigration advocate. Federal immigration officers lied to a local father and businessman about a routine check-in so they could lure him to the Buffalo ICE field office and detain him, a federal lawsuit claims. Omar Ramos Jimenez, the father of a prominent immigration advocate and co-founder of the popular Mexican restaurant La Casa, was arrested by ICE on December 3rd. Ramos Jimenez, 50, is originally from Mexico, but has lived in Rochester with his family for over 20 years. He is currently waiting out an appeal for an asylum claim after he was first detained by ICE in 2013. At the time, Ramos Jimenez was released on a $1,500 bond. In the 12 years since, he has not missed a single court date or check-in with ICE, the complaint says. On December 1st, federal officers allegedly told Ramos Jimenez he would need to visit the Buffalo ICE field office so they could install a new reporting app on his phone. When he arrived December 3rd, he was immediately arrested. Immigration officers at the field office told Ramos Jimenez his arrest was the result of changes in presidential priorities and policies, and that his appeal decision would be expedited while in custody, the complaint claims. His attorney, Grace Zimon, is arguing the federal government denied Ramos Jimenez his right to due process by rearresting him without holding a new bond hearing. She has asked the federal judge to order his immediate release or a prompt hearing on the matter. Omar's detention is another example of the Trump administration's attacks targeting longstanding immigrant community members who work hard and follow all the legal processes required, yet remain at risk due to the Trump administration's cruel and arbitrary deportation agenda, the New York Immigration Coalition said in a statement. Ramos Jimenez and his wife, Maria Bocanegra, opened La Casa in 2013 alongside landlord Lila Wilton. By the following year, the partnership disintegrated and the undocumented couple was ousted from the restaurant they helped create. Ramos Jimenez has since found work, mostly in maintenance, snow removal, and landscaping, according to the complaint. He often offers free help to elderly neighbors. His daughter, Cassandra Bocanegra, works for the Finger Lakes chapter of the New York Immigration Coalition. He also has a 15-year-old son. He is extremely involved in and connected to his Rochester community, the complaint says. As part of his immigration case, over 100 letters of support were submitted from community members. Area Briefs. Local studio that lured artists from around globe is closing. After being in Rochester's neighborhood of the arts for 26 years, Studio 34 Creative Arts Center is closing at year's end. Owner Mary Lynn Lipschitz said she received a call from the building owner who expressed his plan to renovate the 34 Elton Street space at the start of 2026. She said that due to lack of time to find a new location, she made the decision to close the studio and retire. Originally, glass melting was Lipschitz's therapeutic hobby, something to help her with a stressful occupation as a psychotherapist. Over the years, my hobby became a full-time teaching studio with a diverse curriculum and faculty, she said. Over the course of its 26-year run, the studio has had more than 19,000 students and faculty from around the world take and teach classes. Some visiting faculty have been from South Africa and from Germany, while students have come from Australia, Japan, Israel, and more, including Rochester's backyard, the Rochester Institute of Technology. It's both a pleasure and a privilege to have hosted these extraordinary artists, Lipschitz said. Some of the classes and bench rental opportunities Studio 34 offered included fused glass, metals, fiber arts, mosaic, stained glass, torchwork glass, and digital photography. Although classes ended November 30th, the studio will be open by appointment for a going-out-of-business sale until December 31st. To make an appointment, email info@studio34artists.com or call 585-737-5858. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Popular wing spot shutting down Greece restaurant. Country Sweet Chicken and Ribs has announced that it will close its Greece location on December 13th, saying its lease has expired. Country Sweet opened the 4,000 square foot location at 1600 West Ridge Road in 2020. Its space was previously home to Gridadaria's Bakery, which moved to California in 2019 after a 105-year history in Rochester. Country Sweet, which dates back to 1977, is best known for its hand-breaded wings with a choice of sticky sweet sauces. It also offers slow-roasted barbecued ribs as well as several other dinners and sides. Its original location at 1691 Mount Hope Avenue in Henrietta remains open. Owner Marty McCabe purchased the restaurant from founder Tom Lask in 2014. Until its closing date, the Greece location will be open for lunch and dinner daily. Legendary Beatles vs. Stones tribute battle coming back to the Smith Opera House. The tribute production, Beatles vs. Stones, A Music Showdown, will return to the Smith Opera House in Geneva at 7:30 p.m. December 10th. The show features a musical duel between two beloved tribute bands, Satisfaction, the International Rolling Stones show, and Abbey Road, a nationally touring Beatles tribute band. Tickets range from $45 to $65 and can be purchased by visiting thesmith.org or by calling box office at 315-781-5483. Fans attending the concert are encouraged to dress up in fashion inspired by the 60s or in their favorite Rolling Stones and Beatles merch. The Smith Opera House is at 82 Seneca Street in Geneva. For more information about the production and tribute bands, visit www.beatles-versus-stones.com. What to do with the pennies you still have? The U.S. Treasury Department has stopped producing pennies. U.S. Treasurer Brandon Beach struck the final circulating penny on November 12th at the Philadelphia U.S. Mint facility after President Donald Trump halted its production in February, leaving many wondering what they should do with their pennies now. Why was penny production stopped? Essentially, the production cost exceeded its value. According to the U.S. Mint, the cost of producing a singular penny has risen from $1.42 to $3.69 over the past 10 years. The coin had been in production as a circulating coin for 232 years. Can I still use pennies? Yes, you can. There are about 300 billion pennies in circulation currently, and they're still considered legal tender and accepted at retailers and businesses nationwide, according to the U.S. Mint. However, a bill introduced in April could round all cash transactions to the nearest 5 cents if passed. The Common Sense Act would eliminate wasteful government spending and update the U.S. currency system to match reality. U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat of New York, who helped introduce the bill, has supported the penny production stoppage, calling the one-cent coin outdated and inefficient, and says it no longer serves the needs of our economy. What should I do if I have some pennies or other coins I think are valuable? You may have seen one of many headlines blasted online lately about valuable pennies in circulation. Lincoln wheat penny worth $124 million you could have at home, reads one. But the reality is most pennies are worth 1 cent or possibly a bit more. The most valuable U.S. coin ever, a $20 gold piece, a 1933 Double Eagle coin, sold for $18.9 million at auction in 2021. The most valuable pennies, which are rare but possibly still in circulation, are 1943 copper Lincoln wheat pennies, a few of which were produced accidentally, as the U.S. mints were supposed to use zinc to save copper for the World War II effort, John Feigenbaum told USA Today, publisher of Rare Coin Price Guide Gray Sheet. In rare cases, some 1943 pennies have sold for $1 million, while one went for more than $200,000 at an auction in 2019. Depending on their condition, those 1943 Lincoln wheat pennies could be worth at most between $100,000 and $250,000, Feigenbaum told USA Today. but the likelihood of having a near priceless penny is similar to saying your lottery ticket might be worth $100,000. Of course, anything is possible, right? But not likely, said Feigenbaum, who is the PNG's executive director. Even though the most valuable coins are usually in collections and have very publicly been sold and resold, Feigenbaum said, sometimes people may inherit a cache of well-preserved coins or purchase some at an estate sale. Read up on your coins. While there are apps you can use to check on your coins, they aren't always accurate. But you can check the value of coins in the 2026 Red Book, a guidebook of United States coins, available in bookstores and online on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. It answers all kinds of questions like, oh, if I'm thinking about collecting Lincoln cents, what can I expect to pay? Said Feigenbaum, one of the book's editors. You'll see in that book there's no $1 million cents. Go get your coins graded. You can have your coins authenticated at their value, just as jewelry is, from several services, including CAC, Numismatic Guarantee Company, and Professional Coin Grading Service. Canandaigua Teen Services Librarian Honored. Wood Library and the people who make it tick are rolling in the awards of late. Teen Services Librarian Caitlin Katie Smith, who this year marked her 10-year anniversary at the Canandaigua Library, was named the New York Library Association's Public Librarian of the Year. Smith was also named a Rochester Regional Library Council Library All-Star. Wood Library's Reading Garden received the state organization's Public Libraries Building Award. The multipurpose outdoor area, tucked in on the north side of the library at 134 North Main Street, Canandaigua, opened over the summer. Maria Bucci, Director of Development at Wood Library, also was named a Library All-Star by the Rochester Library Group for her fundraising efforts on behalf of the library. Here's part of what was said about Smith and her state honor. Katie has gone above and beyond in her role, fostering a welcoming and inclusive environment where teens feel empowered to be themselves. Her work has not only increased youth engagement with library services, but has also created a lasting impact on the lives of the young people she serves. Many of these teens have grown into strong library advocates, with some even choosing to pursue careers in librarianship, a direct reflection of Katie's influence and mentorship. Here's part of what was said about Smith and her Rochester honor. Katie Smith goes above and beyond to provide a safe, inclusive, comfortable space for the teens of the Canandaigua community. She provides after-hours programs, treks to schools and community events, advocates for both her own programs and other library services, and is always open to helping the teens work through any of the twists and turns that come with the age range. Now here's what Smith has to say about libraries and working with youths in response to a few emailed questions. The answers have been lightly edited. Question: what got you interested in library as a career? Initially, I entered library school with a focus on archives. The plan was to work inside a museum archive. Still, after completing my internship, I realized that while getting to handle fascinating historical documents, I missed the face-to-face interaction with patrons. When I entered library school, my mom had found a picture I drew when I was 6 or 7, saying that when I grew up, I wanted to be a librarian, so everything came full circle. I love getting to work with patrons of all ages, whether I'm helping someone set up an account on social media or sending a fax for them. How rewarding is it to work with teens? When people ask about my job, I always tell them the best part is working with the kids. I've been so fortunate throughout my career to connect with the amazing kids in the Canandaigua community. I've been here long enough that the first kids who graduated with me are the age I was when I first started at the library. Getting to watch these young people grow into outstanding adults is always rewarding, especially when they keep in touch and I can hear how they are doing. Last May, I was lucky to have a big reunion and invited all the kids who had been a part of my teen advisory board to celebrate my 10-year anniversary at Wood Library. I had around 20 kids coming and going through the night. I loved watching my current kids meeting the older kids they've heard so many stories about. Sometimes I feel like the relationship I have with these kids is one of the biggest honors I could ever get with this job. Why is it important for a library to be inclusive and open to everyone? Libraries are one of the last places that people can come to without any expectation. If you're looking for a place to study, you can come to the library without buying anything. If you need a warm place to hang out while waiting for a bus, we welcome you while you wait. The beautiful thing about libraries is looking back at their history and watching how they ebb and flow to cater to the community's needs. It can be a stressful job, but every day I hope that I am able to make someone's day a little easier by helping them out. What are your top 5 or 10 favorite books? It's hard to narrow them down, but my favorite young adult books I always go back to are The Queen's Rising by Rebecca Ross, Six of Crows by Leigh Bardugo, Stalking Jack the Ripper by Carrie Maniscalco, Death at Morning House by Maureen Johnson, and a recent favorite, My Fair Monster by Adrienne Rivera. My most recent reads were two adult mysteries that I very much enjoyed, Everyone in My Family Has Killed Someone by Benjamin Stevenson, and We Had a Hunch by Tom Ryan. What are local teens' favorite books? I love hearing about what the kids are reading. It really ebbs and flows depending on the season. I work with the Canandaigua Academic and Career Center to pick out books for the students based on their interests, and they are loving horror novels and graphic novels. One of the books that passed between a lot of my kids was Gwen and the Art Are Not in Love by Lex Croucher. What do you do outside work? I love to crochet, read, play video games with my oldest son, go train watching with my youngest son, and go out on adventures with my husband. Companies sue to get tariffs refunded. Trump has other legal avenues to pursue duties. As the Supreme Court weighs a challenge to President Donald Trump's tariffs, American business owners are waiting to see what will happen to the money they spent importing goods and whether they can offer their customers a reprieve from raised prices. Costco recently filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration to secure a complete refund should the Supreme Court strike down tariffs imposed under the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act in a separate case the court heard in November. It's the latest lawsuit from retailers hoping to get their money back from the administration. Court records show others include Bumblebee Foods, EssilorLuxottica, Kawasaki Motors, Revlon, and Yokohama Tire. It remains unclear how U.S. Customs and Border Protection would handle a large-scale refund process, prompting some companies to file lawsuits to preserve their refund rights ahead of the ruling, in case the Supreme Court limits refunds to businesses that have taken legal action. That legal action comes at a cost. Beyond legal fees, suing a presidential administration has the potential to upset customers and taint a relationship with the federal government, according to Drew DeLong, head of corporate statecraft at Kearney Foresight. There's so much uncertainty right now that the calculation becomes, is filing a suit worth the incremental certainty that if this action is taken, we're in a better position, DeLong said. It's not a battle every company can take on. If you are a business that does not have the infrastructure in place to navigate this environment proactively in terms of government engagement, you're at less of a competitive advantage than those that do, DeLong said. Just as there are discussions of a K-shaped economy right now in terms of the strength of the consumer on the upside and downside, I think you're seeing a very similar trend emerge with those who have the infrastructure to navigate this environment. Looming layoffs. Mehlan Khosrovian, a spirits maker and co-founder of Green Bar Distillery in Los Angeles, said at the beginning of 2025, his company was paying 25% tariffs. At one point during the year, they jumped to 170% and are now back down to 55%, which is, you know, a lot better than 170, but it's still quite a lot of money for us, Khosrovian said. He said his team is still adding up the total amount tariffs will cost the company for the year, but he estimated they will pay between $75,000 and $125,000, up from the $25,000 to $50,000 he said they were paying before. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Kosrovian said the distillery sources every fresh ingredient it can from nearby farms, but there are some it can't realistically get from producers in the United States, including juniper berries, cinnamon, clove, nutmeg, and coffee. He said they're preparing to lay off both full-time and part-time workers as a cost-saving measure, in part because he doesn't believe consumers can absorb any price increases in the current economic climate. The possibility of layoffs is an open conversation among his 15-person staff. Our staff initially thought it's the governments where we import products from that pay the tariffs. We had to say, no, 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 here's the bill, Kosrovian said. Our entire team went through a number of exercises to find any cost savings anywhere. Ultimately, we couldn't find enough. Forced to raise prices. Thompson Traders, Inc. President Clifford Thompson said tariffs have led the Greensboro, North Carolina family business, which sells sinks, tubs, and custom range hoods, to accrue debt and raise prices. In Thompson's case, he said the challenge isn't sourcing materials, it's sourcing the craftsmanship. He said the company's handcrafted products can't be made in the United States and still sold at a reasonable price. He said his company doesn't have the financial capacity to train employees to do the same work, and even if it did, he estimated the process would take about 3 years. In previous years, he said the amount the company paid in tariffs wasn't something we paid a lot of attention to. Now, he said, the company is on track to pay more than $1 million in 2025. We went from a year that was probably going to be profitable to a year where we're going to break even at best, Thompson said. I wouldn't say it's fully sustainable. We'll figure it out. Thankfully, we've been in business for a while. I think it's pretty detrimental to younger companies. Uncertainty could remain. Kosrovian and Thompson's companies are two of hundreds that have joined We Pay the Tariffs, a coalition backed by the Trade Partnership and other pro-trade groups. The coalition filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court, asking the justices to uphold lower court rulings and deem the tariffs unlawful. Kosrovian said he hopes the litigation ends with the Supreme Court striking down the tariffs. In his fantasy scenario, he said he'd love to bring back some of the workers the company plans to lay off, but that his company would spend it very cautiously because we don't know what's going to come around the corner. Thompson said if his company was given a refund, it would use it to pay down the debt it incurred to pay the tariffs, but that it too would likely bank it for a little while just to see where things went. Their caution isn't unreasonable, according to DeLong, who said people should not assume a Supreme Court ruling will mark the end of tariffs. The Trump administration has several options to implement similar tariffs in other ways. I don't think there is any voice in this administration I am aware of that will say tariffs are not here to stay, DeLong said. They've been crystal clear that this is a cornerstone, and I don't suspect that them losing IEEPA is going to deter the intent of what they developed. Report alleges alligator Alcatraz torture. Amnesty: detainees face unsanitary conditions, mistreatment at Florida site. A global human rights organization is alleging inhumane treatment of detainees at alligator Alcatraz at the Dade Collier Training and Transition Airport in Okeechobee, Florida, claiming some are subject to what it says is torture. A report by Amnesty International claims detainees are being mistreated at the state-run Immigration Detention Center in the Everglades and the Chrome North Service Processing Center, a federally run immigration detention and processing center in Miami. According to the report, punitive punishment at Alligator Alcatraz includes being put in the box, described as a 2-by-2-foot cage-like structure people are put in as punishment, sometimes for hours at a time, exposed to the elements with hardly any water, with their feet attached to restraints on the ground. People ended up in the box just for asking the guards for anything. I saw a guy who was put in it for an entire day, said one man who was interviewed in the report. The report says immigrants detained at Alligator Alcatraz are also experiencing unsanitary conditions, including overflowing toilets with fecal matter seeping into where people are sleeping, limited access to showers, exposure to insects without protective measures, lights on 24 hours a day, poor quality food and water, and lack of privacy, including cameras above the toilets. Immigration enforcement cannot operate outside the rule of law or exempt itself from human rights standards. What we are seeing in Florida should alarm the entire region, Anna Peeker, Amnesty International's regional director for the Americas, said in a news release. According to the organization's report, ICE officials stated that they wholly disagree with Amnesty International's findings, but did not provide additional information. Molly Best, a spokesperson from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' office, called the report a politically motivated attack and said allegations of abuse or negligence have been fully investigated and are fabrications. In fact, running these allegations without evidence whatsoever could jeopardize the safety and security of our staff and those being housed at Alligator Alcatraz, Best said in a text message to the USA Today Network Florida. Amnesty International said its findings were gathered between September 21st and 26th of this year. While the organization was able to access Chrome, they were not able to enter Alligator Alcatraz and said they received no response from Florida authorities. The information about Alligator Alcatraz in the report was then gathered by interviewing four detainees at Chrome who had previously been at the state-run detention facility. The report also alleges medical treatment is inconsistent or non-existent at Alligator Alcatraz, and detainees are housed in cages with very little outside time. While phones are available in each cage, they only allow monitored, collect-pay phone calls, and those are limited to 5 minutes. Included in Amnesty International's list of recommendations are the shutdown of Alligator Alcatraz, an end to 287G agreements between local law enforcement and federal immigration authorities, prohibiting the use of solitary confinement in Chrome, and ensuring all detainees have access to legal counsel. The cumulative effect of these punitive policies and practices reveals a deliberate strategy that dehumanizes and punishes migrants and people seeking safety, with the aim of deterring them from seeking protection or staying in the country, the report said. These policies erode due process guarantees and violate the United States' obligations under international human rights and refugee law. Lawsuit over Alligator Alcatraz. As previously reported, Alligator Alcatraz is one of two state-run immigration detention facilities in Florida, the other being Baker Correctional Institution in Sanderson. Alligator Alcatraz, which opened in early July, has been the subject of several lawsuits which have attempted to shut down the detention center. The state and the federal government are defendants in a lawsuit from the Friends of the Everglades, the Center for Biological Diversity, and the Miccosukee Tribe of Indians of Florida on grounds that the state failed to conduct an environmental review on the land where Alligator Alcatraz is located. An environmental study is required to comply with federal laws, and critics say that federal funds cement the U.S. government's involvement in the facility. While the facility's operations were briefly put on pause in August, a federal appeals court decision allowed it to resume operations in September. In October, the feds said they reimbursed the state of Florida over $500 million for its state-run immigration facilities, a move that plaintiffs called a smoking gun. That lawsuit is still pending. In a statement provided to the USA Today Network, Florida, Miccosukee Chairman Talbert Cypress said the tribe is focused on protecting its ancestral lands and holding the state and federal government accountable for their failure to comply with environmental laws in the facility's original and illegal construction. By protecting nature, we protect humanity, Cypress added. We hope to soon end this dark chapter of history in the Big Cypress. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Monday, December 8th issue of the Democrat and Chronicle. Your reader has been Jackie Cohen. Thank you for listening.